Every summer, Lake Monoman and Tainter Lake in Dunn County turn into smelly green messes when a thick mat of blue-green algae forms there and along slower-moving parts of the Red Cedar River that feeds it. The DNR conducted a comprehensive study to find out the cause, and as suspected, the Red Cedar was found to have too many nutrients suspended in the water. With the results in hand, a group of 23 stakeholders from around the region have come together and formed a partnership with the goal of writing up and enacting a plan to reduce the levels of phosphorus and nitrogen and clear the water up once again. This hour we bring on two men who are helping organize the effort to tell us about the latest news. That's right now on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'd like to introduce my guests. First, Dan Zurr. Dan is a natural resources educator for UW Extension in Eau Claire. Dan Zurr, welcome back to the West Side.
Thanks, Rich. Glad to be here again.
Good to have you. And Paul Liberty is a water resources field supervisor for the DNR's Western District. He is also based in Eau Claire. Paul Liberty, thanks so much. Thanks for being back.
It's good to be here.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you use the Red Cedar River or Lake Monoman or Tainter Lake? Do you remember a time when the lakes were not plagued with the algae issue way back when? Do you have any ideas of how to reduce the algae or maybe the nutrients suspended in the water? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-228-5615. Also interested to hear from people that may be living near these water bodies and see how their lives or their properties have been affected by the issue. 800-228-5615, and you can also post a question or a comment on our West Side Facebook page. We'll do our best to get that on the air as well. So first off, I guess I'll start with Paul Liberty. What's the problem with the Red Cedar River Basin, and maybe beyond what I've already explained during the host intro?
Well, a lot of this stems from the requirements of the Clean Water Act, which is a federal act, and it requires all the states to list their waters that they think are impaired. And Tainter and Monoman got listed for the algae problems there, and there are health issues associated with that. You know, toxins are given off, and people are getting ill from being in the water or even near the water. But there are other water bodies in the Red Cedar that also have related problems, as you mentioned, stretches of the river, some lakes in the upper end. And Wisconsin has listed those waters as impaired, and part of that is an obligation to put together a cleanup plan. And we did that and finally got that approved by EPA in 2012. Mm-hmm. And it looks at what the causes are and what the sources are, and it wasn't too surprising to learn that phosphorus was the nutrient that's driving most of the problems out there. And because the watershed is heavily agricultural, you know, the cropland is an important factor in that, but there are many sources of phosphorus. There are wastewater treatment plants, there's urban areas, and the study identified all those components and how much they contribute.
Yeah, and I imagine, Dan Zurr, that people, as farmers, they're a little sensitive to this whole idea. You know, there's always, I've seen comments either on news articles or even during this show when we talk about this, that people, the farmers might feel like they're getting blamed. So why is that? It's important, I imagine, to stress that they're not the only ones involved here.
Generally, you can say that on average, depending on what the urban land use actually is, but you don't get a whole lot more nutrients coming off 1 acre of ag land versus 1 acre of urban land. Mm. And like I said, it might depend if that's industrial urban land or whatever it happens to be. But the problem is the acreage. There's so much more agricultural acreage especially in the Red Cedar watershed compared to urban, because we've really only got a couple of areas that are concentrated urban areas, Rice Lake and Menominee, and then a lot of other very small communities. So the acreage is the issue. And so if we're going to make a huge dent in the amount of in reducing the amount of phosphorus that's entering the Red Cedar River system, it's going to have to come, a lot of it's going to have to come from the agricultural sector, just because there's a lot of the agricultural land use in that watershed.
And a lot of folks in this region know the Red Cedar. They maybe have canoed or kayaked it. They know the lakes that it feeds. But the basin, you know, the watershed itself is massive. It's I was just talking with our engineer this morning, and he's got a cabin up near Gordon at the headwaters. And this is how many acres are we talking about, this basin or this watershed, Paul Liberty?
Well, we're talking about the importance of cropland in this basin. There's 270,000 acres of cropland. Mm. You know, so, and then you've got lots of forested land as well. So, I mean, it's a very large area. It goes all the way up into Washburn County. Pieces of it are in five different counties. So it's a lot of land and a lot of people that we have to network with to try to make a difference.
So there was something called the TMDL that the DNR did. Could you explain in layman's terms what that means, Paul?
Well, that was the cleanup plan that I referenced earlier. That TMDL is a Clean Water Act term, total maximum daily load, but it's a cleanup plan. And that's what EPA approved in 2012. And it separated out how much is coming from cropland versus how much of the phosphorus is coming from the urban sources. And it set limits on the wastewater treatment plants as to how much they can contribute. And those are regulatory limits that are going to get put into permits. Also, a couple of the communities, Rice Lake and Menominee, have stormwater permits. And so there are limits that are going into their permits as well. There were some goals set for agriculture, but those aren't coming out as regulations as they are with the urban areas. They are implemented through voluntary programs.
And why is that in the state? I think that was an interesting point to make. Why can't the state just say, pass a bill and say, farmers, you have to do this, period?
Well, so a lot of this stems from the Clean Water Act, and that's the way the Clean Water Act is set up with stringent regulations for the urban components and not for the agricultural components. In Wisconsin, we did pass some standards for mm-hmm. agriculture. They were discovering they really don't do the job in phosphorus-sensitive watersheds. They're statewide minimum standards, and they're good targets to meet generally in the state, but in a phosphorus-sensitive water, we're discovering that sometimes you need to go beyond the minimum state standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also alluding to something that if the DNR imposes some restrictions, that there's some kind of a cost sharing involved sometimes with regard to agriculture.
Yeah, on our agricultural performance standards, there are some things that can be regulated, and most of them have a cost share requirement along with them that the enforcement can't take place unless cost share is offered.
Something like 70% paid by
right.
the state, right?
Right.
Okay. So we get this TMDL, and it took something like 20 years, I thought, to gather all of the information. It was completed when it came out. Dan Zur, would you tell us a little bit? There was an exciting part of this that had to do with farmer-led councils, and where have we seen that go?
Well, yeah, the TMDL was approved in 2012, and after that happened, there was a little bit more of a concerted effort. I mean, there's always been. I don't like for people to think that there hasn't ever been anything done.
Right.
Until this plan that we're working on. There's always been efforts to control phosphorus in the Red Cedar River watershed and other watersheds around the area as well. But after the TMDL was approved by EPA, there was a little bit more of a concerted effort to say, okay, we've got this document that identifies the problem, kind of points at where the problem is coming from, and offers, you know, some suggestions as to what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we take that and make it into a little bit more of a concrete plan that says, how are we going to do this? And one of the things that came out of that a couple of years ago was the discussion for, and this kind of came from some people in Iowa, Iowa State Extension at Iowa State University, started to work in parts of Iowa with some county extension people on organizing farmers around the issue of water quality, trying to get them to come together and be their own little, I don't know if you want to say governing agency, but be their kind of own little group that is going to figure out what can we do as farmers, as a community of farmers, to try to do this, this farming activity that benefits us as farmers, but also benefits natural resources. And these farmer-led councils started to form. The Hewitt Creek project in Iowa is probably the one that's been around the longest and has the most success. And we brought some of those people up to Wisconsin to talk about that, to talk about how they were doing that. And it caught on a little bit with DNR and with Extension here, and DNR and Extension kind of teamed up and created a position. Julia Olmsted occupies that position and is housed over at River Falls. And she is a coordinator for four farmer-led councils that have formed in the northwestern part of the state. Three of them are in the St. Croix River Basin, but one of them is in the Hay River, which is a tributary to the Red Cedar. Mm-hmm. And what we hope to come out of these farmer-led councils is that the farmers find ways, and this is what's happened in Iowa, they find ways to help their bottom line that also are good for natural resources. There are things that they can do in terms of lessening the amount of nitrogen they're putting on their land. No-till farming, right, which leaves a residue of last year's crop on the surface and keeps the soil from washing away. Soil is a farmer's livelihood, and soil is lost, mm-hmm, at a particular rate from a particular acre of cropland over the course of time, and it can only be replenished so fast. So the soil needs to stay in place for the farm to be productive and profitable into the future. So the farmers are very much interested in keeping that soil in place. They're interested in soil moisture. And all of those things are a benefit to no-till. And what's really nice about no-till is keeping that soil in place also keeps the phosphorus and the manure that's applied to that soil, which contains phosphorus, from running off into the rivers and streams. So if we can get farmers to take that upon themselves and take ownership of it, rather than this thing that we've been doing for, it seems, time immemorial, 40 or 50 years, where we hold out money to the farmer and say, please farm correctly and we'll give you this cost share money. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have to sign a big government contract that's a half inch thick, and they don't want to do that. Right. They want to be able to figure out, how can I run my farm better? And sometimes it's education. Sometimes it's – a lot of it is earning trust. A lot of it is just working with these farmers and getting them to understand, we're not here to tell you how to farm. We just want to help you be a better farmer for yourself and for everybody else. And I think the farmer-led councils are a good way, not the only solution, but a good way to kind of work toward that.
So is that the farmer-led councils, it sounds like maybe a precursor to this partnership that we've got set up right now. So it's the Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership. That's a bit of a mouthful, but this is a thing that has formed. When did it form, and to what end, Dan Zur?
We started meeting in late 2013, just basically talking about, okay, we are the people. We got as many people in the room as we could that had already been doing some of this work, the land conservation departments in Dunn and Barron County, DNR folks, extension people, the city of Menominee, who has a stormwater permit. We got these people in the room together, and we started talking, okay, if anybody's going to do this, it's going to be us and other people that we bring into this group. So how do we go about doing this? Mm-hmm. And that's very much how it started. It started as a conversation, and it turned into this partnership where we brought in people that initially weren't part of the group. Mike Wendt from 3M is part of our partnership, and 3M is, because of his interaction with the group, 3M is starting to manage the land around their property in Menominee in a different way. They used to lease it out for row crops, and corn and other row crops are much more phosphorus intensive and much more erosion intensive than pasture and hay land. So that's what 3M is doing now. They're trying to lease the land out as for hay rather than for cropping, which is better for water quality. Hmm. So, that came out of the blue. So there are a lot of things happening with that partnership that were not necessarily planned from the start, but have been pleasant surprises. And one of the goals of the partnership is to get an implementation plan, something on paper that says, here's exactly how we're going to try to look at that TMDL document and implement that thing. Try to get those phosphorus levels down to where the TMDL says they should be. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're in the process of doing, is writing up a plan for that.
Paul Liberty.
One thing we probably should explain a little bit is the relationship between this group we're describing and the farmer councils.
Okay.
One of the things that we do when this larger group gets together is we all compare notes on what everybody's doing, what the cities are doing, what the county conservation departments are doing. And Julia, with the farmer-led groups, is there explaining what's going on as well. And one of the things that the this planning group is trying to do is hear what all is going on and try to set the stage for these things to be more successful. And we hear what's going on with the farmer-led, and one of the important things that we're trying to figure out is how do we create the opportunity for more of that to happen, for us to have more than one farmer-led council. And so that's one of the things we're looking for. The other thing that's very intriguing that's coming out of the farmer-led councils is, you know, what Dan was talking about earlier falls into the concept of soil health. And that seems to be what they're gravitating towards. And it builds up the soil. It makes the soil behave like a sponge. And it's really good for agronomy, and it turns out it's really good for the environment. And so it's a way for the farmer to be more effective, more economical, and it helps the environment. And that's what's coming out of these farmer-led councils. We're finding this win-win situation, and we want to try to empower them as much as we can and see more of that happen.
A reminder for our listeners, we're talking about the a few things here. Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership. It's about 23 different stakeholder groups involved in trying to figure out how to reduce levels of excess nutrients like phosphorus in the Red Cedar River, which do contribute to ugly blue-green algae blooms on lakes throughout the watershed. Most well-known perhaps in Lakes Menominee and Tainter. Excuse me. And you can call in. The number is 800-228-5615. We're also going to be talking about a watershed management plan that this group is coming up with to try to reduce the levels of these nutrients in the water. I'm joined by Dan Zur. He's a UW Extension Natural Resources Educator. And Paula Liberty is a Water Resources Field Supervisor with the DNR in the Western District. 800-228-5615 is the number to call. And we're going to take our first break. We'll be right back with more discussion on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good Monday morning to you. Thanks for listening. We're talking about the Red Cedar River and an issue it has with nutrients, too many nutrients that cause algae blooms along the river and in lakes that it feeds. There's a watershed management plan that is being drawn up by a Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership. It's all part of a huge effort that has been years in the making to try to address the issues that face this watershed. We've got two men on the program today that are kind of leaders in this whole effort. We've got Paul Liberty. He is a Water Resources Field Supervisor with the DNR. And Dan Zur is a UW Extension Natural Resources Educator. They're joining me in the studio. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. Do you live along the river, the Red Cedar, or do you use it? Do you have any concerns for it? Or any ideas of how to help reduce the phosphorus and reduce the algae blooms? 800-228-5615. I just want to talk about, you know, before we get into the management plan, having a stakeholder group of 23 different, you know, organizations. Is it like herding cats? I mean, what have been some of the challenges that have come up that you might not have expected? And Dan Zur, I'll start with you.
I think what's really interesting is we meet, the group meets monthly. There's about two dozen individuals representing somewhere around 13 or 14 organizations. I mentioned a few of those organizations. DNR, obviously, yeah. UW Extension, Dunn County, and Barron County both have Land Conservation Department folks there. And a county extension people as well. West Wisconsin Land Trust, the City of Menominee, mm-hmm. a couple of lake associations, the Tainter-Menominee Lake Association, the Desert Lake Association, Farmers Union, Tom Quinn from Farmers Union is part of the group.
Sure.
So there's a lot of folks that are there. And when we get together, what I kind of facilitate the meetings, and what I always have trouble doing is stopping conversation. because we kind of let everybody report out what they're doing in their little corner of the universe with water quality, And once that exchange starts happening, everybody kind of starts to feed off each other and has questions. And before you know it, the clock is ticking and we need to get some other work accomplished. Mm-hmm. But those sharing moments are really, really good. I think a lot has come from that. But in terms of difficulties, I think everybody is cooperating with each other in so many wonderful ways. And there's so much collaboration and interest between the parties. I think that's one of the really great things that's come out of this effort is that the counties talk to each other more than they probably would have before and are trying to coordinate some of the things they're doing. We got data, scientific hard data for the planning purpose from Dunn and Barron counties that normally would have taken them probably a year to compile just because they have so many other things to do.
Sure.
But it was like, we need this for the plan. And they turned around and they got us the data that we needed, assessment data, basically what's going on in some of these farms. How many barnyards are out there that are really not behaving the way they should be? How many acres of a particular land conservation practice are happening, and how many more are we going to need? Data on along those lines that normally is hard to come by. We got, they turned around and got it to us in a big hurry, which was incredible.
Paul of Liberty.
Well, there's also a financial incentive for us to put this plan together as part of the Federal Clean Water Act. Not only are they looking for these cleanup plans, which tend to be pretty scientific, and figure out where it's all coming from, but they're kind of short on details on how you would actually clean it up. And so the second installment of that is what the EPA calls an implementation plan, and that's what we're working on now. And that also goes through an EPA approval process. And if we get enough detail in there and get it approved by them, it opens up a pathway to some federal cost-sharing money that we could invest in certain key spots in our plan. So that's a financial motivator to put this plan together as well.
All right. Well, we've got some callers, and I'd like to get them on the air and hear what they think about all of this. First, we're going to go to Lynn in Colfax. And, Lynn, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Yes, I'd like to ask if all the farmers were using the proper tillage methods, would our lake be clear? And if not, what would the next step be?
Excellent question. Paul, I'll go to you on that. How big of a difference could no-till no-till agriculture make if everyone did it?
Well, we went through some scenarios as part of putting this plan together, and what turned out to be pretty impressive is you don't have to get everybody to do it to make a noticeable difference. If you target to some key areas where there's a lot of phosphorus coming off the land, you can make a big difference. And, tillage is important, it's a very useful tool. So you can make a difference with tillage changes, and it doesn't have to be every single farm.
All right. Lynn, thank you for that. We've got open phone lines. The number is 800-228-5615 to call in. I think we've got another caller here. I'm not sure who it is or where they're calling from. Caller, are you there?
I am.
All right. If you could state your name, where you're from, and what your question is.
Well, I can't stay on the line. I just want to – the question would be – the origins of all of this and whether or not I mostly want to say thanks to the farmers and particularly this one fellow for taking the initiative.
All right.
And how he was obviously trying to solve a problem that he had, but I think it resulted in the grassroots of where we're at today.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Paul of Liberty?
Well, that's been a very impressive aspect of the farmer-led process. Is there are farmers out there who are concerned about the environment, who are good farmers, and are willing to mentor others. It's impressive because farmers are in competition with each other, for selling their commodities. But they've figured things out, and they're helping each other out, and they're taking time out of their busy schedule to sit on these councils, and they're great problem solvers, and it's fun to see them in action.
Mm-hmm. So we've got this. We've got the TMDL. It's basically a blueprint for what is going on, what the issue is. We've got this management or this partnership of 23 different groups. Now we're working on a management plan. So is this basically Dan Zur? Is this basically the instruction manual for how to fix the red cedar?
Well, I would say that's one good way of describing it. It's got a lot of great ideas for ways that we can address the phosphorus issue. There are different sources. How do we address those different sources? You know, there's a certain amount. The TMDL stated there's a certain amount coming from cropland. There's a certain amount coming from urban and so on and so forth. And there's a whole suite of different things that can be done on those various landscapes.
So how do you decide what to put in this plan to submit to the EPA and the DNR?
Right. Well, the group talked about that, and Paul alluded to it a little earlier. You know, we're targeting high, you know, areas that we think we've got a map that says here's some of the watersheds that have probably more phosphorus load being contributed to the overall river basin than others. So we can target maybe some of those heavy polluting areas. We can target places where the county land conservation folks think there's already the possibility to maybe organize some farmers and get them to start learning from each other and doing things differently. Some of it is dependent on financial resources available. Do we have money available to address that particular land management practice? Is there a grant out there that we can go get that will help fund this? And one of the things that we're hoping is that by organizing people and raising consciousness and getting this whole concept of buy-in and ownership by the people on the ground that are managing land, if they can feel part of this and feel like they're doing it for themselves as well as for the greater water quality in the watershed, then it probably won't take quite as much money, because it's not going to be that bribing situation where, you know, if you don't want to do this by yourself, maybe you'll do it if we hand money out to you. Mm-hmm. If they come to realize that we can do things differently and increase our bottom line and come together as a community and do this right, we might not have to spend nearly as much money as we think we do.
If I could just go back a little bit, you mentioned some specific areas. You've both mentioned specific areas where it seems like there is more of this nutrient runoff happening. Can you name them? I mean, where are we talking about?
Well, the big divide is the very top of the watershed when you're up in Washburn County and some of the lakes up there. That's mostly forest.
Yeah.
And forest contributes some phosphorus. Every land cover type contributes some level of phosphorus to runoff. But forests generally don't. They're pretty good at keeping most of the phosphorus in place. The soils and the litter on the ground and other things kind of all contribute to them being less of a problem. And then as you get a little bit farther down, about one-third of the way down in the watershed, you start to run into the land that's been modified more. Mm-hmm. You start to run into more urban areas, Rice Lake, Barron, some other places, and you start to run into all the cropland. Historically, there is a little patch of the Red Cedar watershed that was oak savanna, that was a little bit of prairie.
Sure.
But for the most part, this was a forested part of the country. And when you cut that forest down and start modifying it, which we've been doing for over 100 years, you change how things happen. So on that land that's been modified and changed, those are the areas that we have to focus on. And then there are smaller watersheds within that chunk of land that have a higher percentage of modified land cover. And those are kind of the areas where you can kind of generally point. And then when you get really specific, when the land conservation people of each county are surveying the land, they can go out and they kind of know there are some individual spots, some individual fields where we have problems. You can look at a field and see if there's an erosion problem on that particular field or on that particular farm. So there's all kinds of ways that we can target and ways that we can approach that.
Paul Liberty.
Looking at agricultural land, there's some pretty simple concepts that I think most people can relate to, that a flat sandy field is going to probably run off less than a sloped field with tight soils. Mm-hmm. And that's also part of targeting, is to look at those fields that are liable to deliver more and see if there's anything we can do to help the farmer adopt some different practices, and through a combination of things, improve their bottom line and have less runoff.
So we're talking about, excuse me, we're talking about maybe walking up and knocking on a door if you see something, or is it less upfront than that?
Well, the whole concept of a farmer-led effort is farmers talking to farmers.
Right.
So if there's any door knocking going on, it's not a government agent.
Right.
It's a farmer talking to another farmer over the fence.
We've got another caller on the line. This time it is Mike in Rice Lake. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi. You know, first of all, if I want to say is that I like the idea of the farmer-to-farmer idea because there's way too many times when you'll get a blank stare or somebody showing you the hand.
Mm-hmm.
If you're any kind of a environmentalist or government person coming onto the farmyard and saying, you know, we've got a better way for this to work. But the problem is that we do need to make sure that we have some way to give a backdrop, I think, to the farmer helping farmer, that either listen to the farmer helping farmer or there will be something else over here. Mm. And I say that from, you know, I was a past chair in the Air, Waste, and Water Space in the Conservation Congress, worked on some of the phosphorus lobbying and legislation. And I could tell you that there is, from the facts and figures, as you've already tried to explain here, it's the ag land which is really the issue when we're talking about excessive phosphorus loading. And just now I'm driving in the Rice Lake area, and during this call, I've gone to about six different dairy farms, where the dairy barns are right up on a creek,
mm-hmm.
or a, you know, some other kind of drainage area that also, you know, since in the Red Cedar watershed, are all going into Red Cedar, and there's no berms, there's no buffers to speak of, and these are big problems. That's not even getting into the cropland itself.
Mm-hmm.
These are huge problems you're going to have to deal with, and we're also going to be running against, you know, the I've been a farmer all my life, who are you to tell me? So that's why I like this farmer-to-farmer approach. But we still, I think there still needs to be some iron in there someplace where, you know, where you give them a choice. Not so much you just go in with the one option, which is we're going to talk with you and hope to convince you. But it's, you know, guys, here's these good alternatives. I'm a farmer. I know what I'm doing. You know, I know what I'm talking about. Let me help you understand it. But remember that if we don't control this, then there's going to be this something else.
Sure.
That comes up behind it.
All right. Mike, thanks so much for the call. So, Paul of Liberty, it sounds like he's saying, you know, we're offering some carrots here, but should we have a stick at the ready?
Well, the stick are performance standards, which we mentioned before, and right now most of them do have a cost share requirement. So, I mean, our ability to go that route is controlled by the availability cost share money, but for the really obvious bad conditions, there are some options.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're discovering with these watershed studies is, you know, we can get those really bad obvious ones, but that probably won't be enough either. We've got all this cropland that we've got to do something with as well. And the regulatory approaches just probably aren't going to work as well on cropland as they might on a bad barnyard.
Sure. And Dan Zier.
Yeah, there are pieces to the puzzle. There are lots of tools in the toolbox, and as Paul alluded, there we actually identified, I was talking earlier about some of the data that the county's collected, we identified about 70 barnyards that probably need some work.
Mm-hmm.
So those areas will be targeted because there are legal aspects to that. If your barnyard is not doing something right, there are those guidelines out there that say you need to be doing something better.
Yeah, what is it, NR-151 or something like that? Or?
Yes, that's one. There's some other ones too, but that's one of the regulations that applies to this kind of activity. So, but just those 70 or so barnyards won't fix the problem.
Yep.
We're definitely going to approach that problem, but there are other places where the only thing that we have is a carrot. We don't really have much regulatory authority to go in and say you have to do A, B, or C.
Even with the the mighty DNR being part of this.
Yeah, there are, as Paul talked about earlier, the Clean Water Act kind of controls, that's a federal law that kind of controls a lot of what states do. And Wisconsin can only do so much under those various regulations, along with state regulations,
right,
that are what you would call the stick. There are some things that well, we'd like to see these other things happen, and we'll offer cost share for that, but we can't force you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So in situations like that, that's where we have to do a little bit more of this, getting people to kind of figure it out for themselves and help them along, give them the assistance, give them the help, give them the trust that they need between the various groups to help them accomplish those tasks.
We're talking about the Red Cedar River and Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership. It's a group of 23 different organizations, local governments, farmers, what have you. They're coming up with a watershed management plan that aims to reduce the levels of phosphorus in the Red Cedar River, which in turn should eliminate or at least reduce the levels of unsightly blue-green algae that pop up during the summer months. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. I'm joined by Dan Zur and Paul LaLiberty, two of the organizers of all of this, or the people that are helping keep everyone on track. The number again is 800-228-5615. We're taking our final break here on the west side. We'll be back to wrap up the discussion, talk about a conference that's coming up, and get a little bit more information about this management plan. This is the West Side. You're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. I'm Rich Kramer. I'm also joined in studio by Dan Zur. He's an UW Extension Natural Resources Educator. And Paul LaLiberty. He's a Water Resources Field Supervisor for the DNR in the Western District. We're talking about the Red Cedar River. Also, Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership, a group of 23 different organizations with the one goal of cleaning up the levels of, or lowering the levels of phosphorus, cleaning up the algae in the lakes that the river feeds, also in the river itself. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. We're also going to be talking right now about a watershed management plan. We've just started to pick at the tip of the iceberg, if you will. It's a plan to basically enact years and years worth of study to reduce the levels of nutrients like phosphorus. 800-228-5615. So this management plan, Dan Zur, the partnership has been coming up with this management plan. Can we spill some beans about it before it's unveiled to the EPA and the DNR? Like, what are some of the specific plans that we haven't talked about this hour yet?
Well, we've touched on a good bit of it. We break out in the plan. We kind of break out the amount of phosphorus load that we think we can target from different sources,
okay.
and we talk about the different ways that we can do that. And no-till farming, which we've talked about, is certainly one of them. Repairing barnyards is certainly one of the things that we talked about. Getting phosphorus soil levels down. A lot of dairy farmers, especially, have been putting their manure on the land at a particular rate for their entire career, because that's the way my dad did it, or this is just the way we've always done it. And sometimes the soil doesn't need nearly as much phosphorus as is being applied. And if we can pull that back by applying less phosphorus and pull down that soil, soil phosphorus concentration, that will also be a help to the water quality. And I mean, all those numbers, and that's certainly all part of the plan. But I think the big thing in this plan that is unique and is, I don't want to say new, but it's newer than some of the other approaches, is really this idea of organizing people in the watershed to kind of take ownership of this process themselves.
Yeah.
We say farmer-led councils. That is kind of the model that we're using, but there have been other efforts in the watershed and in other places where things of that nature, building trust with farmers, has happened. There was a project in the Red Cedar in the town of Grant up near Colfax a couple years ago, where some education was done and bringing farmers together and having some field days and some cookouts, where farmers learned a lot of stuff, and guys that that never did no-till were offered the chance to do that by the project provided the no-till equipment, because that's a big thing. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars of equipment investment. A farmer who's never done that is not going to say, I'm not going to spend you know, $10,000 or $20,000 on this piece of equipment if I don't know how this process works and if it's going to be good for me. So they would come over to somebody else's farm and get the information about how that process works, how successful it's been, what the yields have been, what the profitability has been. And that wasn't so much a farmer-led council as just a kind of concerted effort to build trust within that one little township. So those kinds of things, I think, are the focus of the plan, where we're going to find every way we can to help people understand it better, help them organize around it better, and help them be better farmers and better community members because of the efforts that we're doing.
And there's a conference this week happening. When and where? And what are we talking about? Red Cedar River Water Quality Partnership getting together for a soiree. Where's the conference and what's the main goals, I guess?
Well, this is the I think it's the fourth year now that we've done the conference, and it's going to be happening this Thursday, the 12th, at UW-Stout in the Student Union at UW-Stout. Last year we had about 250 people there. We've been increasing a little bit every year. And we're proud to say that of last year's attendees, about 40 of them were farmers. And to get farmers to come to a water quality conference is pretty unprecedented. Normally these conferences are kind of geek fests where the people that are working on the problem sit around and say, well, we've done this. And we've got farmers coming to these conferences, learning from each other. Some of the things that we've got happening at the conference is a farmer panel. We've got three guys who farm in the Red Cedar who are going to be sitting up there talking about their operation and looking at the people and the farmers in the audience and saying, what do you want to know? What kind of questions do you have from us?
Paul?
Well, and I mentioned soil health earlier, and one of our keynote speakers is Ray Archuleta, who is a national expert on soil health and making soil health work for farmers, for their economic operations, and also for the environmental benefits. So he's a very entertaining and informative speaker, and we're all looking forward to hearing Ray.
We've got some more calls. I can tell how much people love their Red Cedar River and the lakes and in the region, because we're getting a lot of calls, and that's great. Right now, going to Colfax. Glenn in Colfax, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned about the runoff, and I thought there was some ordinance or regulations developed that are going to go into effect about buffer zones. Could you explain what a buffer zone is that'll help reduce runoff?
All right.
And if there is an ordinance, what the ordinance is and when it'll go into effect?
All right. Paul Liberty, that's for you.
Well, there was an ordinance passed by Dunn County, you know, so it's limited to just Dunn County, which is a good part of the watershed. And they passed an ordinance requiring some setbacks in terms of how close to the streams or lakes that a farmer can till, and requiring a strip of vegetation. And I'm not that familiar with exactly, you know, the timing of when all the various provisions kick in, but there's some varying widths there depending on what's going on in the farming operation. But all of that, everyone, whether you're in an urban area or you're in an agricultural area, is going to be expected to provide some level of vegetative cover on the edge of the water body to help with erosion problems. And in and of itself, that's not going to solve the problem because there'll still be runoff, but it's one of the important steps, and we're very grateful for Dunn County for taking that move.
And we've got another caller from Colfax. Kay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Oh, what a great program. Thank you for doing this. The pessimists that I talk to who have lakeshore property talk about that there is sediment in the bottom of the waterways and that it's going to take years for that nutrient-rich sediment to stop giving off part of what's causing our problem. And I was just curious if the plan is going to address that or if that's actually not something that's of concern, and I will take the response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Kay. I can actually speak to that a little bit. We've got Half Moon Lake. They had a big project to get the to reduce the phosphorus levels, but that was not with regard to algae. It was more about curly leaf pondweed. But in that situation, it gets locked up. The phosphorus can get locked up in the sediment. In this case, it was sawdust. Paul, Little Liberty?
Well, at Half Moon Lake, it's quite a different situation.
Yeah.
It's a very small watershed, and they spent decades cutting off the supply of phosphorus from the small watershed into the lake.
Right.
And when they did that, what was left was the phosphorus laying in the bottom of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came by with an alum treatment to try to tie up that phosphorus as kind of the final step.
Yeah.
It's a little more difficult in situations like the Red Cedar, where you have dams and flowages and you have things constantly moving in this giant watershed. But the caller is right that there are various places in the watershed where the suspended sediment can settle out and get stored. It can get stored in wetlands. It can get stored in the stream channels themselves and in the bottoms of the lake.
Are we talking about just dead algae that sinks to the bottom or something?
Well, we're talking about phosphorus that is stuck on particles.
Okay.
Most of it is probably on silts and clays. Some of it might be on organic particles. And that's something that you do need to address. We don't have a concrete plan for it right now, because the load going through there is so massive that right now the stuff in the sediments is kind of irrelevant.
Right.
But as we become more successful and we cut the loads down, then we're gonna have to look at those sediments. But we don't have a detailed plan for those right now.
Still a lot of work to do, I guess, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, still some work to do.
So we've got the management plan is, from what I understand, a couple months away from being finished. Could you explain, Dan Zerv, real quick, what happens afterwards? You submit it to the state and federal governments, and then magically dollars start flowing to you?
Oh, if only it was that easy, Rich. what happens is we will submit it to DNR and EPA, and once it's approved, then the Red Cedar River watershed becomes eligible for some certain grant programs that are already out there. Those grant programs are already there, and we could apply for those grants already, but we would get more points on our grant application if we have this approved plan in place. So what will happen after that is we'll look at grants and see if there's some particular grants that we want to apply for. But more than anything else, this same group that we've organized, this partnership, one of the things in the partnership's mission statement is basically we are the body that in perpetuity is going to oversee water quality in the Red Cedar. Our purpose isn't just to write this plan. Our purpose is we are the folks that are going to be working on this problem. And so we will become the implementation team. We will become the team with maybe some additions of people that we haven't thought of yet that we might need down the line. But we will become the body of organizations and people who will lead this effort as far as we need to take it. The plan itself is a 10-year plan that accomplishes part of the goal that the TMDL laid out. So after the 10 years, we'll reassess and we'll figure out, okay, what do we do? What do we need to do now? I consider the plan a beginning, not a final point. Okay, we're done now. Everything's going to be fine.
Sure.
It's a beginning. And I think this group understands that we're going to be the folks in perpetuity that are in charge of this. Nobody else is going to do it if we don't.
Every topic we ever have on the show, it always boils down to funding. So grant funding is great, but it's not always the most consistent thing. So what happens if funding does dry up, either at the EPA level or at the state level? I mean, we've certainly seen some proposed hits to the DNR and extension and UW system. So is the plan in danger then if cuts like that happen?
I think there are aspects of the plan that will be more difficult without certain financial resources, without certain human resources. Some of the people in this group might not be around because of the budget cuts. So, you know, what do we do after that? What do we do with those people that might not be there?
Mm-hmm.
You proceed with what you have, and we will do whatever we can with what we have to work with. We always hope that all of the resources that we need are out there and available somewhere. But as I mentioned before, a lot of this is going to be based on getting folks to understand that there are ways to do land management that are good for you in your business and as a farmer or whatever it is that you're doing that are also good for natural resources that not only won't cost you money but might actually improve your bottom line. So we're hoping that a lot of that comes from this process.
All right, we've just got about a minute left. If we could maybe make another pitch for the conference and what folks can expect there, Paul LaLiberty.
Well, I mentioned Ray Archuleta, and he, I suspect, is going to be a draw for farmers. We also have a very interesting keynote speaker who's taken the time to canoe and even fly a lot of the water resources and has a really nice overview of the whole watershed, and also a speaker to talk about how people can mobilize to make a difference. And I think there'll be three great speakers.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. That's our time. I'd like to thank Dan Zur of UW Extension and Paul LaLiberty of the DNR for their discussion. I'd also like to thank Team Westside, including Mort Cypress for on-air production, Henry Lippold for helping produce the hour, and of course, Dean Collenbeck and Debbie Brown for keeping it all on the rails. Next week, we're bringing on lawmakers from Western Wisconsin to discuss the state budget and other bills being debated in Madison. Should be a lively discussion. I'm Rich Kramer. Have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.